Gina Gardner had to learn how to walk twice in her life. For over 20 years, she ran her award-winning school from a wheelchair. That's quite the feat, and I'm anxious to hear what she has to share about that. But she focused on what she could do rather than what she was not able to do.
Have you ever felt like giving up, quitting, throwing in the towel? Welcome to Never Ever Give Up Hope, featuring Carol Graham. She's an author, health coach, and motivational speaker. Backed into a corner multiple times in her life, Carol shares with you stories on how she overcame some of the toughest obstacles a person can go through in life, but refused to give up hope. Rather than admit defeat, an opportunity was presented, and it involves each and every one of you. Carol will feature spectacular guests who will share their messages of hope, encouragement, and their inspiration to prove why life's adversities only make you stronger. And now, welcoming the host of the show, here's Carol Graham.
Today with me, I have Gina Gardner. She is a number one international best-selling author, and she'll talk about her book a little later. She is a motivational speaker. She is an empowerment and relationship coach and transformational leadership trainer. She's had well over 30 years of experience helping people experience happiness, success, and fulfillment. Welcome, Gina, to Never Ever Give Up Hope.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm really thrilled to be here.
And we are thrilled to have you. I just love to hear the stories, and especially the encouragement is during this time when people are doing a lot more listening because they're looking for sources of encouragement to help them in whatever they happen to be going through, not just in life, but especially during this time when the whole world is going through this. Now, it is obvious from your bio that when I was reading it, that you have a strong will. And also that you teach determination. You have to be a determined individual in order to teach it. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your journey and how you developed this strength.
My childhood was much like many people's. I wasn't particularly happy at school. I was often bullied. And so when I started teaching at the age of 21, I was very fortunate to find who I was. So my journey. My childhood was much like other people's. I wasn't particularly happy at school. I was often bullied. And by the time I was a teenager, I had very bad eczema and was slightly overweight and just felt I didn't fit in. It wasn't until I started teaching at the age of 21 that I really found who I was and something that I was really good at. And I loved teaching. I was promoted very quickly. I became the deputy principal of the largest, I think where in the US it would be the equivalent of a junior high school. I was promoted to be the deputy principal at the age of 28 to the largest school in the district. Wow. And I was promoted to be the catalyst for change. So I was the youngest two on staff. And my job, as I was told, was to help bring the school into modern ways of being. And I and the head worked really hard over the first 6 months. And I was very, very pleased to get to the February half term. Now, in the UK, in the spring semester, we have a week off half term. And I was a keen skier and I went off to ski. And in those days, it was fashionable to have skis that were as long as possible. And during the weekend, I managed to wrap that extra 10 centimetres around my neck several times. And on the Thursday, I had a bad fall. So I said to my friends, I'm not coming skiing with you tomorrow. I'll meet you for lunch, which I did. And they said, we found this amazing run. Come with us. So off we went. It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining. And we went up in the chairlift. And as we got off the chairlift, I followed them. And they rounded a corner and it became pretty evident what they expected. And far from it being this amazing red run, it was the Schindlergrätz, which was the most difficult black run in St. Anton. And it was full of moguls. And for those people who don't know what a mogul is, it's where the snow has been carved out by the weather and it creates lumps. Now, they can be like cobbles, a couple of inches, but these were 6-foot monsters.
Oh my goodness.
Very steep, very long. And I'd skied black runs before, but nothing like this. So I managed about the first third, and then I had a fall. And it took me about 20 minutes to ski down to where my friends were sitting still on the slope, because it was a very long slope. Each of them sitting on a mogul, like an elf sitting on a mushroom. And so I took my skis off and I joined them. And as I say, it was a beautiful day. And the top of my mogul had melted. And it just gave way. And I started to fall. And there was nowhere to land because it was so steep. I knocked myself out and came to some distance down. Took a long time for them to ski to me. And I didn't want to get the blood wagon. But the good thing about it was between the skiing and the two falls, actually, most of the ski slope was managed. So with their help, I went back to the hotel and travelled back the next day. My mum took me straight to accident and emergency, and I was diagnosed with a serious concussion. And it took me 2 or 3 weeks to get back to school. A few weeks later, I was due to be the deputy leader on the borough ski party going to Switzerland, and I was given permission to go because we had a medic with us. During the week, I became a bit like Quasimodo, and I was finding it more and more challenging. And on the very last evening, I said to my colleagues, I've got to go and lie down. So I went up to my room and I lay on the bed. And within a very few minutes, I discovered that I was paralysed down one side. I just couldn't move. I was really concerned. I didn't want to frighten the children by calling out. And so I had to wait for somebody to come. And that time seemed just endless.
Oh, of course.
Once somebody arrived, then all hell broke loose and I was carted off to hospital and then transferred to Geneva Hospital. And I was there just over a week and then I was flown home. And it took me till the end of May to get back to school. I wasn't right, but I was managing school and sleep. And so was very pleased to get to the school summer holiday and thought, I've got 6 weeks, I can really rest and recuperate. 10 days into the holiday, very early in the morning, I got a telephone call, and it was the principal's wife, and she was just absolutely hysterical. And it turned out that she had just found her husband, my principal, he died in his sleep from a massive heart attack.
Oh my goodness.
Far from it being a restful holiday, I helped her manage the funeral. I had to tell the staff, the pupils and parents, the local authority, and I had to get prepared for September. So I was acting principal for a term, and I was then appointed to be the principal in the January. And I was absolutely determined that my health, which I was still not right, wasn't going to get in the way. Over the next 20 years, and I was the principal for 20 years, I had two situations where I ruptured a disc in my back, and on both occasions I had failed back surgery. And so although I'd started to use a wheelchair in 1987, the ski accident was in 1983, initially I just used a wheelchair to get around school, didn't use it in the classrooms or in the hall or in my office, but I used it to save energy. But by 96, when I ruptured the first disc, I was completely wheelchair bound. It took me 18 months to walk to the end of my very little garden. And then 3 months later, I ruptured a second disc and once again was completely wheelchair bound. And that continued for the rest of my time as principal. Now, there was a real gift in that. I mean, don't get me wrong, there were some very dark days. But there was a gift in that I had to find a way of empowering people to take responsibility for their own performance and a shared responsibility for the performance of the rest of the staff. And it was very successful. The school was on the 100 best schools in the country list twice during my tenure. We became one of the first Beacon schools. And I worked with hundreds of teachers and dozens of other schools to help them implement the same principles and strategies. I was invited to be an advisor for the DFES while I was a serving principal, and I worked for the National College of Leadership and the London Institute, not all at the same time, I have to say, but our budget was very poor and it was a great way of bringing money into school and also keeping us at cutting edge. The gift in all of that challenge was creating a unique way to develop and empower people and to develop enlightened leadership. And I still use those strategies with businesses and individuals today.
One of the things that you said that I thought was really interesting as you were sharing was that you were the catalyst of change. I thought that was an interesting way to describe yourself. Do you promote that in when you share with other people, that they too should be a catalyst of change?
I think everybody has the potential to be the catalyst for change, for good or negatively. I think in that instance, it had been recognised that the school had got sort of stuck in doing things in a particular way, and that nobody ever challenged why they did it. You know, we've always done it this way. Why would we need to do it any other way? And during the 70s and early 80s, particularly in the UK, there were huge shifts in education and methodology and technology. And the teachers within that school, many of them had been there since they started teaching. And none of that new thinking was being used in school. And so part of I think, why I got the job, and certainly the interview focused on, what would be the things that I would bring? What was my expertise? What was my thinking around education? But I certainly think we've all got the capacity to be the catalyst for change.
Do you think that possibly your accident had anything to do, or do you think you already had that stamina and that tenacity before the accident?
That's a really interesting question. I think my upbringing certainly helped. You know, if ever I was bored or fed up or unhappy as a child, my parents' whole sort of attitude was, well, go and do something useful. Ideally, go and do something for somebody else, but, you know, don't just sit there, take some action. And certainly that's helped me throughout my life. And I'm reminded of the time when, you know, I came out of hospital having had spinal surgery. I found I couldn't put my weight through my feet at all. I was completely wheelchair bound. And 4 days after I came out of hospital, I was back at school. And, you know, people have said, well, that's remarkable. But if I'd stayed at home, the only thing I could do was watch daytime TV or read. If somebody didn't leave a cup down and fill the kettle, I couldn't make myself a drink. But I could go into school, my brain worked, my mouth patently works, my hands worked, and there were people there who could do the heavy lifting. So I could be at home and focus on what I couldn't do, or I could go into school and operate effectively doing something that I loved and made a positive difference.
Absolutely.
So it was a no-brainer for me. I mean, as an aside, 5 months later, the consultant said to me, I think you might think about you going back to school a couple of hours a week. And I just laughed because I'd been part-time for 3 weeks and then full-time thereafter. And I'm not suggesting that you know, other people in that situation that, you know, that my way is right for them. But for me, all the way through, the focus on what I can do rather than dwelling and focusing on what I can't do has been an incredibly empowering experience. And I would suggest that people think about, you know, how they self-limit and whether there are things that they could do that would make their life much better if they chose to focus on what they could do.
Now, during those low times, and you obviously had to have them. I mean, you're a human being, right?
Yeah.
And considering what you went through, especially in the earlier years, how did you gain that, I don't want to call it knowledge, but that determination to, as you said, look at what you could do instead of what you couldn't? Is there a pivotal point or someplace in your life where you made that decision, or do you think, as you mentioned earlier, that this was basically in your upbringing?
I don't think there's a single pivotal moment. But I think my childhood was significant, but I don't think it was the only thing. There are certain lessons along the way. I can remember I made friends with somebody in hospital, and we kept in touch after hospital. And every time that we spoke, she focused on how dreadful it was and how awful she felt and how unfair it was. And I came off the phone call, or I came away from the visit, and I was just exhausted. And she taught me a really important lesson. And that important lesson is, if you focus on all of that negative stuff, then you feel grim.
That's right.
Whereas if you focus on even just making a small inroad, doing something constructive and positive, you feel better. And so work for me has been a huge, it's been my pain management, not only my physical pain management, but my emotional pain management. That by focusing on helping other people and doing things that actually I really enjoy, then I feel good about what I'm doing and I feel physically better. I laugh because I used to say to people, you know, getting up in the morning for me is like resurrection. Even now, it's my worst time of the day. I hurt, I'm stiff, and it's a real struggle to get up. I don't sleep very well. And so the first thing in the morning is not a good time. And I can remember saying to people, there is no decision for me to make. I'm going to school. And at one level, one could argue that was perhaps a bit stupid at times, and I fully accept that. But what it meant was that I would get through that really difficult bit, and I'd go into school, and I'd get busy and interested, and I'd feel better. You know, the pains, aches and pains would become less evident. The focus was on external things rather than focusing on me, and I found that to be very helpful.
I think that's, you hit that bang on. I absolutely agree. Now let's back up to 2004.
Okay.
What happened there?
So I went to see my consultant on May the 19th in 2004, and he gave me an ultimatum. And the ultimatum is that I could continue doing the 14, 15 hour a day, 5.5 days a week that I was. And if I did that, within 18 months, he felt that the body would completely break down and I would be entirely housebound. I had made the very difficult decision that I was going to leave school. Now, in England, taking early retirement on health grounds is quite challenging.
Really?
And it takes most people months to get the decision for them to leave. And so I made this plan. I have to laugh at myself because the best laid plans of mice and men. And my plan was that I wouldn't apply for early retirement until the school summer holidays. And on the Wednesday before bank holiday weekend, which is the last weekend in August, I sent in the application with the doctor's reports and the consultant's reports, fully expecting that I'd get a decision about Christmas time. And so I'd planned how I was going to tell the staff and the children and parents and my colleagues. And about that time, it had been decided that I should have an internal spinal stimulator fitted. And that's like having an internal TENS machine, which is actually wired into the spine. At the time, it was cutting edge. They're quite common now. And you had to have the temporary one for 2 weeks, which was external, and then if that worked, then they'd do the internal one. And the only time they could do it was September, so I knew I wasn't going to be in school for the first 2 weeks in September, because with the external one, you couldn't be near any other people. I was really shocked the day after Bank Holiday Monday, so it's not even a week, I got the decision which said, you're retired from now. So I phoned them and we negotiated that I should be allowed to continue to work until the end of October. I went into hospital in September and I had the temporary external spinal stimulator fitted. It worked, and then I had the internal one fitted and I had huge complications. And I didn't come out of hospital until the end of November.
Oh my goodness.
By which time I was retired. I have to say I really struggled when I first retired. I was back being the eczema-ridden, angst-ridden, overweight teenager. Who was I when I wasn't being a principal? What was my value? What was I going to do with the rest of my life? Because, as I said to you, daytime TV isn't going to do it for me. So I gave myself a couple of months to recover, and the spinal stimulator has taken a long time, but now my mobility is the best it's been, but it wasn't quick by any means. So here am I, we're at the beginning of 2005, and what am I going to do with the rest of my life? So my thought was that the issues that faced us in education around leadership, I believed were the same in any industry. And so I set up a research project across industries to look at emerging leadership and the development of senior leadership within retail, manufacturing, local government, finance, insurance, a whole range of industries. And surprise, surprise, people are people, and the issues that they faced were exactly the same as we'd faced in education. So I wrote my first two books, Kickstart Your Career, How to Be a Professional Grown-Up very quickly when you're transitioning from the world of learning and education into the world of work. And that was based on the experience we'd had of training teachers as graduates. And we were unusual as a school that we had a license to train teachers without reference to a university. And what I'd found is that people were very knowledgeable about their subject. But, you know, they talk about common sense, don't they? In my experience, common sense is it's pretty rare, isn't it?
Yes, and absolutely.
So the book was a distillation of how we help people to become professional grown-ups. And then its sister book, How to Manage a Staff More Effectively, was a distillation of all of the techniques that I'd used to develop managers within my own school. And they became my calling card for my work, which is mainly with corporates. And so I've always done life coaching, even when I was a head. But I worked initially with corporates doing training, facilitation and consulting.
How do you help business owners lead with compassion? I thought that was very interesting in your bio, that how to lead with compassion so that you can reduce conflict and stress within the workplace. Is that in one of your books or is that a program that you teach, or expound on that?
It's very much part of the Enlightened Leadership Program, which I've just launched. For me, Enlightened Leadership is about integrity, compassion, and the courage to do what's right rather than what's easy. And I've worked with, since 2009, I've worked mainly with not corporates, but with businesses and business owners. And I think the first thing is that in order to lead with compassion, you have to lead yourself first. You know, your ego should be left at home in bed under your pillow with your pyjamas or your nightie. You need to take radical responsibility for your thoughts, your actions, your words. And to start with, you need a great relationship with yourself, because every relationship you have with other people is a reflection of the relationship you have with you. Now, compassion and leading really from a place of love does not mean that you let people get away with stuff. It doesn't mean that you're an easy touch. In quite fact, quite the opposite. But it does mean that you have to walk your talk. It does mean that you have to care about your people, and they're your treasure. And so many, I mean, you look at the quality of leadership as it is at the moment, and whether you're talking about entrepreneurs, business owners, politicians, and the result of that is a huge cost at an individual level. You know, in the UK, over half the prescriptions are for antidepressants. And most people cite work at least as a major contributor to their stress, anxiety, and depression. If you're going to teach compassion, part of that is that it has to come from a place of genuine authenticity. Mm-hmm. You have to care. It's no good playing lip service to it. If you don't truly care about people, then they recognise that. You have to, as I say, take responsibility for yourself, because if you're a leader and something is going wrong, it's very easy to blame that person. But in the work that I do with people, it's much more about what have you done or failed to do that has contributed to that situation happening. So if I may, I'll give a couple of examples.
So what type of programs do you offer?
There are a number of programs. The Enlightened Leadership Program is designed to help people lead, as I say, with integrity, compassion and courage. It's a deep dive look at yourself. It's a 9-month program, active program, 10 months actually with the beginning and the end, fully supported, all done online. It's accredited by CPD Standards Office. And there it helps people recognize how they can really lead themselves, looks at their beliefs, the relationship they have with themselves, the language that they use to themselves and others, and gives them the strategies to recognize that they are enough, to have huge self-worth, but without ego. But alongside that, running how the strategies and principles and techniques of being an enlightened leader. And that program is really a culmination of over 30 years' work. I have a one-on-one coaching program for people who want to make differences in their life and want to do that quickly and want support to do that. So that's called the It's All About You program. And then there's a membership group called the Thrive Together Tribe, which is a paid membership for people who would like support, who want to have to really feel seen and validated, who there's a structured program of self-development, personal development and spiritual development within that, which is delivered through videos, activity books, themed journals, and twice monthly interactive coaching sessions on the internet. There's a program called the Personal Empowerment Plan, which is for people who are feeling stressed, and every Sunday evening, a pep talk, a strategy, a principle, a technique drops into your inbox in your email, and that's something for you to try for that week. And that's a 6-month program. If you want to improve your relationships, there's the Relationship Bridge, and then there's huge amounts of free stuff on the website for people to dip into, including a free TV series that they can look at with lots of different themes such as forgiveness and self-sabotage and being happy.
Do people separate the books from the programs, or do you recommend that they do both?
Certainly, Thriving Not Surviving is an integral part of the Thrive Tribe and the Leadership Program. And the Leadership Program, I also use Kickstart Your Career and manage your staff more effectively. It's the principles that are in the book are expounded in the program, and people are supported to actually make those principles and strategies part of their daily living. But those people who want to who prefer to read, then the books can give you, certainly they give you the skeleton, if you like. The programs are what clothe the skeletons and make those skeletons move.
That's a very good way of putting it. I appreciate that. So tell us some of the success stories or testimonials, if you could, please.
If you're talking about business, let me give you two examples.
Okay.
A laboratory that makes teeth. They make crowns and they make implants. When I first went to work with the business owner, their turnover was £550,000 a year. Every member of staff was on piece rate and everybody had their job and they just did their job. The owner was stressed to the eyeballs because everybody referred to him for them to say, is this good enough? They looked to him to do their thinking for them. They worked long hours. They used to start sometimes as early as 6 and often not finish till 7:30 or 8 in the evening in order to get the work done and for those on piece rate to earn the money that they wanted to earn. I worked with the owner and his wife who did the office and finance work, and later on with a member of staff who's now become a manager when he's not there. And we implemented a range of things. But first and foremost, the owner started to take responsibility for himself. He started to model the behaviours he wanted from others.
Excellent.
He started to treat people differently. We implemented a situation where people went on to salaries. And the organisation has become a learning organisation. So rather than people saying, is this okay? Part of what they're doing, they have a development day every Thursday where teaching goes on by everybody to everybody on a rolling program, so that people started to understand and be able to carry out the roles of one another. And so now they have a model where they will look at a job, and if it's very complex, they'll decide who's best to do what within the job. The net result is that their turnover last year was $890,000. They start work between 8:30. Most nights they're finished by 5:30, and Friday afternoon by 3, they generally go to the pub. They're on salaries, and they have a profit share for a percentage of the profits. They're happier. The owner who was talking about selling his business and how unhappy he was is enjoying life. He's about to embark upon a big course which will change the business, and the manager that has been trained will, to a large part, take over his role because he is going to be qualified to do some of the clinical work with implants. So that's one example that I think it really demonstrates that by the senior person taking responsibility and shifting the way they think and they work, that amazing things happen. The second example is of a hotel. And initially I was commissioned by Essex University to go and do a communication course with the three newly arrived directors. They'd just inherited a large country hotel. It was in £8 million worth of debt. Occupancy only happened between Monday and Thursday night and was running about 45%. During the day, the hotel was empty. As I started the communication course with them and were talking to them, it became pretty evident that that was going to be a plaster being put on a boil. And I said to them, would you like me to carry on, or I think there's some fundamental things going wrong? It turned out that their general manager was stealing them from them, and that the staff were dysfunctional. So I started to work with them on a consistent basis. And the first thing that we did was to create a vision for the hotel, that the three directors were very clear about what that vision would be, and to identify their roles and responsibilities. Because up until then, one of them had done all the work and the other two sat back. And I could say things that perhaps would have caused a family row if one of them had said it. But then we started to look at why was the hotel struggling? And part of it was because nothing was done strategically. So if they had an event, they thought about it the week before and started to advertise it the week before. So we created a strategic plan that went over 18 months. So if there was going to be an event, the PR and the marketing for that was done 9 months before. And what you see now is the hotel now have a debt of £1 million. They have refurbished the entire hotel inside and out. Before lockdown, they were running at 87% occupancy 7 days a week, which is incredible for a hotel. They are busy with morning coffee, lunch, afternoon tea, conferences, weddings. The hotel is vibrant. It's won awards. Why? Because they and their senior managers, who've all been through this training, take radical responsibility for themselves and shared responsibility for their teams. This stuff works. But it's not for the faint-hearted. It's not for people who aren't prepared to do the inner work.
Right, right. And do you apply the same principles to an individual as you do to a corporation when they are using the programs?
Very similar. The principles of, you know, you are the common denominator that you take into every moment of your life from the moment you're conceived until you die. So taking responsibility for yourself, the focus might be different. So, for example, let me give you an example of many people are in victim mode. You know, they're unhappy and they allow other people to determine their emotional state. You know, he made me unhappy. She made me frustrated. But if you take radical responsibility for your own emotional state, nobody can make you unhappy or frustrated or angry unless you choose to give them permission. Now, that's not to say you don't get angry and frustrated, but ultimately, you know, don't hand the responsibility of your well-being to somebody else. So although the radical responsibility may be focusing on different things, it's still about taking radical responsibility. It's about being your own best friend and having a great relationship with yourself. And that's just as important in business. So lots of things the same, but just looking at it through a slightly different lens.
I see. That's a very good explanation. So in conclusion, what would you like to leave with the audience? Because you've covered such a great area here, so many different things, and you're obviously very well versed, and you have a passion and a compassion for people to help them, and obviously you're not stopping yet. I can
No.
You're just beginning. So what would you like to leave the audience with today? What little tidbits?
I'd like to say to you, you know, life's not a spectator sport. You know, ultimately, what you decide to do is down to you. If you wait for other people to do it for you, they might never do it, and they might not do it in the way that works for you. So I would say, you know, the old saying, if you always do what you've always done, you're going to get the same result. If you want a life that is full of happiness and purpose and fulfillment, then take charge of it. You know, if you need some help, reach out. I find it quite interesting that people will have their car serviced to stop it going wrong, but they won't necessarily invest in themselves.
That's good.
And yet, you know, investment in ourselves is never wasted. And I'd say to you, you know, happiness is a choice. You can choose that you'll be happy when you've got the great car and a great relationship, and you don't have to nag your children to tidy their bedrooms, and, you know, all of those things are placed, the and, the happiness syndrome. Or you can get up in the morning and think to yourself, I've got so much to be grateful for. I'll be happy every time I have a nice cup of tea or a hot shower, or I see a beautiful flower or the clouds in the sky. And instead of I'll be happy when, always in the future, I choose to be in the moment, because that's all we've got, and be happy now.
What an excellent summary. Thank you so much, Gina. That was absolutely perfect. And you are the true motivator, and you can't help but listen to this interview and not be motivated. And I challenge our listeners to listen to it more than once, because Gina has so much to offer and so many encouraging words, and she certainly has led by example. What you went through, and yet not allowing that to change you, but only to make you better. And I really, really appreciate that, and I know the audience will as well. You said some key things which I appreciated. One was to lead by example and to lead with compassion. And if you're going to do that, you lead yourself first. I think that kind of sums up a lot of what you said today. When you do the things, it's like teaching children, and you can't expect them to do one thing and you do the opposite, and you doing the same thing. No matter what you have gone through, no matter what you have endured, you are still leading by example. You pull up your bootstraps, you get up in the morning, and whether you're in pain or not, which I appreciated what you said about pain as well, that you just do it. That decision is made already. You just walk with it. You go through it. You do it. You take that first step. And so that motivation, that encouragement, I sincerely appreciate. Thank you so much, Gina.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And listeners, thank you for listening to Never Ever Give Up Hope.
Thank you for listening to Never Ever Give Up Hope, featuring Carol Graham. Did you know that most people succeed because they are determined to? Quitting was never an option. Carol loves your comments and will respond to each one. So please subscribe and review this podcast. A rating of 5 stars would be outstanding and appreciated. Remember, if you are still here, there is always hope.